Access number 12551, Rule 1.
Colonel Wooldridge, Rule 1. Could we start with your telling me where you were born, please?
I was born in Solihull, Warwickshire, in 1929.
And what did your father do for a living?
He was a buyer with the Halford Cycle Company. And he did that until the war. He'd been briefly in the Merchant Navy in the First War, and he went back into the Merchant Navy in the Second, mistakenly, in my belief, and was virtually invalided out after a couple of years and two Atlantic crossings.
Did you pursue your schooling in Solihull?
Yes. I went to a little prep school in Oulton, which is all nearly in Solihull, and I went to Solihull School, which used to be a grammar school, is now a public school, and I went in between the two. And a fine school it was.
Where were you living when the Blitz occurred in 1941?
In Oulton, which is a sub-area both of Solihull and of Birmingham. And we used to traipse down into the air raid shelters. We had one in our garden, which we shared with other people.
What kind of a shelter was that?
It wasn't an Anderson, nor was it a Morrison. Obviously, a Morrison was for indoors. It was a brick-built one, built by a private contractor, and it had room for two bunks in it. And my mother and I and neighbours cowered in there while the anti-aircraft guns went off, and we heard the bombs coming down. I think my main memory was walking to school looking for bits of shrapnel from the AK-AK shells. When Birmingham burnt on one particular occasion, we got an awful lot of cinders and ashes showering down. But my main memory was in daytime. They dropped about eight delayed action bombs on countryside behind my house, all of which went off during the day. It was quarter, half a mile away. It didn't break any windows or anything. But it was quite interesting.
Was there any danger in collecting the shrapnel?
No, it was all bits of metal. I suppose it might have been sharp and cut you, but there was no question of it being anything that would blow up, although there was the odd incendiary hanging in trees, but I never happily found any of those.
Was the shrapnel hot?
No, oh no, no. It would be next morning, and I would be walking to school long after it had fallen down. I did go to one of these unexploded bomb craters, and my proudest possession was a sheet of metal with a bit of yellow, which must have been a tail fin of the bomb. I suppose it was about a foot square, but with jagged edges. And that was a great trophy.
What did you all do with it once you played?
Well, we showed it off at school, and then I suppose it must have been thrown away. I certainly haven't got it now.
Did you swap it or something like that?
Yes, we used to swap bits of shrapnel. If you got a bit that looked as though it was a long sliver and someone else had got a great hunk, you'd perhaps swap a sliver for a hunk or vice versa. You didn't find it every day you went to school, only occasionally. Didn't have a massive great collection of it.
Did girls do this or was it just boys?
Well, I suppose I was 9, 10, 11, 12. I think I can say I wasn't too interested in girls in those days, except perhaps to throw the shrapnel at them. But I don't know is the answer. We had a girls' school very near to us, and they too cycled or used the same bus as we did to get to school, but I don't think they ever bothered about shrapnel.
How frightened did you get in the bombing?
I don't think I really appreciated what could happen. I think my mother was frightened for me, and as we dashed out in the dark, falling over the rockery on our way to the shelter where the air raid siren went, I don't think I was imaginative enough probably to be frightened. I can remember that when the siren went, I had a sort of feeling in my stomach sort of rising up. And I looked forward to the all clear. I can remember that. But no, I can't remember being frightened.
Because we sometimes hear about allegations that young children had nightmares because of the bombing.
I don't think I was one of those. I don't think I ever did. Not that I can recall.
Did the Blitz or any aspect of the Second World War cause any privation as far as you were concerned personally?
I didn't think so at the time. When I remember what my ration was of butter for 1 week, I don't know how on earth we managed or how my mother managed. But I wasn't aware of privation. No, if I was hungry, I had something to eat. And of course, expectations in those days were much lower. We didn't have all this television, or we didn't have a fridge, didn't have washing machines, they still used mangles. So perhaps there was less to lose when water was cut off. It's not very nice having water cut off now, but I can't ever remember the electricity going off, actually, which is strange.
How did the bombing and the war generally affect your attitude towards the enemy?
I suppose at that time I thought that I hated the Germans. I must have done, I suppose. And one heard these awful stories, which sadly many were true, of the way they behaved. Since the war, since I'd been to Germany, and since the thing I was best at school was learning German, I became much more pro-German. And I think I still am, with reservations. But then no member of my family directly suffered as a result of German action, I would think I would be right in saying. So I'm not really, I haven't been biased against them.
What kind of stories penetrated to you about the Germans?
Oh, well, we heard all about the concentration camps, of course, and it so happened that the Warwicks, which I later joined, had a nasty massacre, which most people know about, at Oradour. And I think news of that seeped through into Warwickshire, which is where I was living. And of course, later on, when I went to Germany, I went to Belsen, long after it was razed, and colossal mounds of 5,000 Jews buried here signs, and things like that. It's difficult for me to distinguish between what I've picked up since and what I thought at the time, but I think I must have hated the Germans, because that was the thing generally to be done by boys.
Was there any anti-German propaganda in the schools?
None that I recall, no. I recall none, not in my school. We dug trenches. Sowley Hill School had large playing fields. And when war broke out, or when it was about to break out, we all went and helped dig trenches all around the side of the school playing fields, which in due course were filled up with concrete and turned into school air raid shelters. So I do remember that, but I don't remember anybody saying, "Down with the Germans," or anything.
So where did you pick up the anti-German feeling? Just the fact that we were at war with them?
Yes, I think so. And I suppose before that, before the war, as a boy reading comics and things like Rockfist Rogan, who fought the Germans, a natural enemy to me, I think, as a small boy, appeared to be the Germans. And I suppose I must have taken in bits about Hitler ranting and raving at Nuremberg and so on. Well, gosh, I was small then, I suppose. Perhaps I'm being wise after the event. But I think I would be safe to say I grew up thinking the Germans were our natural enemies, which I no longer think.
Did you feel at any stage that Britain would lose the war?
I don't think I was qualified to judge. I don't think I would ever have contemplated that. I remember that I had begun at that stage, when I was 11, 12, 13, taking a great interest in the Royal Navy as opposed to any other part of our services. And I spoke to a sailor on Snow Hill Railway Station in Birmingham who told me that there was a dreadful secret that nobody knew, and that it was that the Valiant had been sunk and I was to keep it to myself. He obviously couldn't keep it to himself. And I suppose that did shake me, and I can remember being shaken when Prince of Wales and Repulse went down in the Far East. I think both those things had more effect on me than Dunkirk, for example. I don't think I was worried about Dunkirk town. I think I thought the RAF would cope, which they did.
Where were you on V-Day?
I always get slightly confused between VE and VJ. VE was May, I think, wasn't it?
Yes.
One was May, one was July, I think, or August. I think VE Day, I must have been in London on top of, on the roof of a tram. If VE Day was the victory parade, I saw the victory parade. I don't know whether it was VE or VJ. I went up to London on my own and stayed at a youth hostel to see the parade and celebrate. I'm surprised my mother allowed me to do that, come to think of it. But anyway, she did, and I did, and I enjoyed it.
What do you remember of the parade?
Lots of soldiers, mainly, marching past, airmen and sailors as well. I was in the Mall. I'm not sure I didn't get up very early to get to the Mall to lie down under the trees to make sure I had a good seat. I must have gone with a friend from school, two of us, Peter Cannon. Yes, must have done. And I just cheered and saw people marching and liked the bands. I remember the Highlanders, I think I'm right in saying, marching past. I really can't remember much about it. I must have gone up on the train, certainly, because that's the only way you could get to London in my youth.
Did London look a mess?
I don't remember it looking a mess, no. No, I don't. Not compared with Hamburg, which I later saw about 5 years later, 4 years later.
How did you come to join the forces?
First of all, when I was about 13 years and 4 months, and I took the exam for Dartmouth. I've always had and still have dreadful handwriting. And after I'd done the papers, for which I hadn't done any work at all, my master at school said, well, you're never going to pass that because they won't be able to read what you've written. And he was quite right. I then stayed on at school. In the holidays, to earn some money, I used to go and work in a bookshop in Birmingham called Hudson's. I used to be paid £1 for every Saturday I did, which was well, very welcome. And the good lady, I worked in the bookshop because it was owned by people who lived opposite to us, and the good lady who owned it said to me, why don't you join the army? You can go to Sandhurst and you can get a military education. Wrong, a university education with a military bias. Well, I didn't think I was going to get to university. I wasn't even sure if my parents could afford to send me there. So I thought, oh, well, this is a good thing. Let's have a go at this. So I took the Civil Service Commission exam, and I went to Nepcastle, I think it must have been, at Horsham or somewhere, and passed an RCB and was told I had been selected to go to Sandhurst. And I really went thinking I was going to get a university education with a military bias. In fact, although I have no regrets at all, I would have said the education at Sandhurst, which was in those days 18 months, which is much longer than it is now, if you'd done a higher school certificate, as I had, by the time you left Sandhurst, you'd just about reached the same standard that you arrived with in those subjects. If you'd done school certificate, as I had done in many other subjects, I would have said it was a bit above that. So it certainly wasn't a university education. It certainly wasn't a military education. Of course, the last thing they taught you at Sandhurst was how to actually train soldiers or do anything. It was very academic. And although you knew how to administer a division in theory, you hadn't any idea how to run a platoon. I only went on the range once at Sandhurst, and when I became a platoon commander in due course, I'd learnt more about how to run a range from the time I served in the ranks, which was then compulsory for 4 or 5 months, than I ever learnt at Sandhurst.
So did you think that it was an inadequate preparation for what was to come?
I thought it was an excellent preparation for what was to come in about 10 years' time. 5 or 10 years later, in that it gave you a jolly good rounded education. I mean, I didn't just you were made to study some subjects, and you could choose the most esoteric subjects, such as meteorology or photography to study, or astronomy, as far as I know. It broadened you, as a university should, in that I joined the Polished Bun Club, which was a select company of about 10, who used to go and read medieval English poetry to each other one night a week. The most unusual things you wouldn't expect to find in a military academy. So it rounded me, it did me good, it produced marvellous discipline in me and enabling me to understand discipline and leadership. And I think it was very, very good at that. But it did not fit you to be a platoon commander. You were ignorant of the basic facts of weapon training or everything except drill, which they didn't add to nauseam, of course, at Sandhurst. So I don't regret going there, and it was jolly good. And I think it ought to be longer now, not necessarily in the same way as it was when I was there. But it gave you a great grounding, really, for your army life if you were going to stay in the army.
Then you were commissioned into the Warwicks.
Yes, I was indeed. I joined them at Warwick, where it was, of course, recruit training national servicemen. I realise now that was very good for me. You did the same thing every 10 weeks, same periods of training. When you joined a regiment in those days, as a young officer, you were required to be drilled by the regimental sergeant major, which I was, and happily he's still alive, and he's a great man. You attended an NCO's cadre, so you did learn then some of the things I think you ought to have been taught at Sandhurst, but weren't. And so before you were let loose on the national servicemen, you learnt a bit more about the practical side of army life. Fortunately, of course, you had first-rate corporals and sergeants, and they really supported you and held you up and kept you going. The major blot that I think of, although happily nobody else seemed to on my career at that time, was when I committed what I thought was unforgivable. I took my platoon on the range as instructed, which was about a 3-mile march from the camp at Warwick, and when it came time to go, Private Simmons, whose name I will never forget, came up to me and he said, "Sir, I've lost my rifle." And I said, "Don't be silly, Simmons, go and look for it." So Simmons went to look for it, and we formed up ready to march back, and there stood Simmons. And I said, "Where's your rifle, Simmons?" He said, "I told you, sir, I've lost it." So I said, "Well, you can't have lost it. Where did you leave it?" So he told me where he'd left it on the firing point. So the platoon searched the range very briefly, couldn't find it. So I thought, oh dear, went back, marched back to camp, went into the company commander. "Have you had a good day on the range, Wooldridge?" he said. Yes, I said, "so very good. There's one slight hitch. We've lost a rifle." "What?" he said, and went berserk. I nipped off to the mess and had lunch while he alerted the whole battalion to the fact, the whole training centre at Warwick to the fact that they'd all going to march out to the range that afternoon and look for this blasted rifle, which they did. They sent people into pools. They never, ever found it. I think on reflection it perhaps was taken by one of the numerous dubious characters that one had in national service, secreted very carefully somewhere, and then with the aim of flogging it for arms for Palestine or somewhere. But anyway, it was never found. I was surprised not. There was a board of inquiry into it. At no time did anyone ever reprove me other than the first reaction from the company commander. They all felt so sorry for me. They'd also made a slight blunder in that they sent me to the range with only one corporal. As I've said, I wasn't well versed in running ranges, so perhaps they felt a measure of guilt themselves. I don't know. Anyway, that's enough of that, Ashton.
How did you find the conscripts in general and their attitude?
I've always said that it was a first-rate thing for the nation, but dreadful for the army. But it's not, that isn't quite fair. Of course, you've got a massive range of talent and ability. You've got many who didn't want to be there at all, some of whom eventually enjoyed it very much and, in fact, wanted to stay on. You've got many who didn't mind. You've got intelligent people. You've got intellectual idiots. You've got every sort. And it must be good for people of so many varying aspects to mix and learn how to act as a team. I mean, I had one man who I think was slightly mentally used to come up and walk up to you and put his head on one side and say, "Isn't it a lovely day, sir," with a smile. And he'd do that to any officer he saw walking about. And we had people called PSOs in those days, who were personnel selection officers. And this chap was given to him to try and sort out. And I know I was asked my views, and I think he was eventually invalided out. The main thing I remember about that time were the passing out parades, when the parents would come and see their young boys who'd gone off with long hair. They'd come up to you afterwards, it happened on more than one occasion, and they'd shake you by the hand and they'd say, "Thank you, sir, you've turned my boy into a man." And you did feel a bit of pride then, not that you'd had much to do with it, but it was quite encouraging. But after 18 months of that, I reckon you'd had your share of training people.
You went to Austria to do some garrison duty there?
The battalion the Midland Brigade Training Centre reformed itself as the 1st Battalion of the Royal Warwickshire Regiment. And I was sent off on an anti-tank course to learn to be an anti-tank platoon commander with a 17-pounder anti-tank gun in those days, which was quite a big gun and really a thing for the Royal Artillery. So, yes, I went off and did my course at Netheravon, which I thoroughly enjoy, and went to Austria.
Which year would this have been?
This was about 1951, I should think. Russians were still, of course, in Vienna. We went to Graz, which was where the battalion lived. We exercised, of course. We also had to send a company periodically to Vienna to take part in the guard duties. I can remember at that time that I'd never seen a steak of meat. You were talking about rations before and privations. I had never seen a steak, or I can't remember seeing a steak, a fillet steak of beef, until I went to Austria. And there we were in Graz eating omelettes and beefsteaks in the restaurants. We trained hard in those days. For the army, it was marvellous. Heaven knows what it was like for the civilians. You could train anywhere. You were told don't smash people's houses or wreck their gardens. But if you've got to drive through a garden on an exercise, or do you drive through a garden, they will be paid damages afterwards. So don't worry. The main thing is the importance of doing it correctly, tactically, which was quite a thing when you had a 17-pounder anti-tank gun on the back of a thing called a Cambridge carrier, which was a small tank. And I remember one exercise, we drove right across Austria and the roads were icy. And if you applied a tiny bit of brake on one side on the track, the gun, the pivoting on the towing eye at the back, pushed you off the road, as it did on one occasion with me, and we went straight down a bank. And the only way we could get out was to drive through somebody's garden and knock the edge off the roof off their house, as we did it, only a tiny bit, fortunately. As I say, they got damages, but I don't know that that consoled them. But that was a great time. As far as I was concerned, I learned to ski during the time I was in Austria. As I say, I could speak. I wasn't too bad at German, and so I was able to feel more at home, perhaps, there than many. But it was still very much an occupation power, and we were on top and the Austrians were not. So we lived well.
Was there ever any friction with the local population?
Not that I recall, no. I think we were a fairly well-disciplined battalion. I don't think people generally tended to get drunk and smash things up. Not even the officers. But no, I think it, we got on very well with the locals, actually. We had a very good commanding officer called Pat Birch, who'd been a prisoner for most of the war. But he didn't hold that against them. No, it was a marvellous time. We trained hard, we played hard. I've always been a sports player. I was able to play all the games I've always played, like hockey and athletics and rugby. And as I say, I learnt to ski, so I looked on Austria. I also got married during that time, and my wife came out for the last few months in Austria. So I look on back on Austria as a very happy time.
Were there any marriages between the soldiers and the Austrian women?
Yes, a few. Not many. I can only think of one officer who married an Austrian. And that lasted a lot longer than most marriages do nowadays, I'm afraid. However, that did eventually break up about 20 or 30 years later. And they had a son, whom I know. But as far as the soldiers go, I can't remember anybody marrying an Austrian on that tour at all. I'm not saying they didn't, I just can't remember.
What was the general attitude of the Austrians towards the British soldiers, as far as you could tell?
I thought they were all right. It was alleged that Graz was a hotbed of Nazism during the war. I can't think they could have welcomed us, but I saw no signs of resentment. I mean, we went to their restaurants, they welcomed us. Well, we were spending money, I suppose. But I never met any unpleasantness, and I met a lot of friendliness. No, I wasn't aware of any animosity.
Did any of them ever speak to you about the war?
No. No, they didn't. And I suppose I didn't speak to them much, really, about the war either. I don't know, one thought perhaps it wouldn't be too tactful. I don't think I'd be quite so tactful nowadays, actually. No.
How long were you in Austria for?
2 years.
So that would be 51-52.
Yes, that's right. And then I suppose we must have been warned for Korea when we were in Austria. I can remember several officers being overjoyed at the thought of getting into some war. I can remember actually then being, oh gosh, I don't want to get a war. And off we set anyway.
Can you understand their attitude?
Oh, yes. Yes, I can.
What's the explanation for it?
They have more power to behave as they like, with less restraint, I would say, and excitement. I suppose it's very difficult. When you're... Yes, I've got no experience, really. I've never wanted to kill anybody, and happily, I've never directly have killed anybody. But I suppose when there's a team of you doing something exciting together, like jumping out of an aeroplane, which I have done, you get a terrific bond. And perhaps war does that. I mean, lots of good things in war, but anyone who wants war is mad, in my view. Anyway, it was... all academic, happily, because by the time we got there, there wasn't any war.
When did you ever